Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking about cancer. And we thought it would be a good idea to do something that was kind of general, to talk a little bit about what we have learned about cancer, the kind of progress that we have made on fighting it, and give people the chance to ask some general questions. And that's what we'll do in this first hour of the show. We certainly do know that this year, something like 1.4 million Americans will be diagnosed with cancer, and over 565,000 will die from it. However, the news is not all bad. Improvements in diagnosis and treatment have resulted in significant increases in survival rates. Our guest for this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. John Ruckdeschel. He is the president and chief executive officer of the Barbara Ann Karmanis Center, the Barbara Ann Karmanis Cancer Institute and Cancer Center. He is also the Associate Dean of Cancer Affairs at Wayne State University School of Medicine. That's in Detroit. The Karmanis Center Cancer Institute is among 41 comprehensive cancer centers in the United States designated by the National Cancer Institute. He is an internationally recognized lung cancer physician and researcher who has consistently been placed on America's top doctors and best doctors list. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And questions certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. So that if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, you'll want to use that number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that means if it would be a long-distance call for you, you use that one, and we'll pay for the call. That is 800-222-9455. So 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, if you have questions, you certainly can call us. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to keep their comments brief so that we can keep our program moving along. But certainly anybody who is listening is welcome to call. Dr. Ruckdeschel, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
A pleasure.
Just to talk about big numbers, that we talk about the number of people who will be diagnosed with cancer. That is indeed a big number. And do we certainly know that I believe that it is next to second only to heart disease in cause of death here in the United States. So those are indeed big numbers. But we have indeed been improving our ability to diagnose and treat cancer now for some years. Can you just in big terms talk about the trends, and is there reason to be encouraged?
Well, yeah, on a number of fronts. I think that first and foremost, the drop in cardiac-related events is pretty stunning over the past few years. And so sometime in the next decade or so, I think, unfortunately, cancer will probably get up there with cardiac disease as the major cause of death. But the overall rates for cancer have been dropping. And of death from cancer have been dropping. And there are a couple of reasons for that. First of all, we've really finally made some substantial progress in smoking cessation. We're now down to a pretty hardcore group of smokers. And the effects, we've already seen lung cancer deaths start to take a downturn. And I think what you'll see is that over the next 20 years, those rates will go down further. And since lung cancer kills more people than the next five cancers put together, you will begin to really see some significant drop-off. Mm-hmm. In other areas, like breast and prostate cancer, much of the progress is because we have halfway decent screening tests. We pick it up earlier and are able to treat it early and hence cure it. And we do a lot better that way. And I think in all of the cancers, we see a little bit of an effect of treatment of more advanced disease, where we are doing better at each step of the way, not necessarily curing everybody, but doing better at each step of the way, so that the overall survival figures are really finally for the first time leveling and dropping a little bit instead of increasing exponentially.
Mm-hmm. If you look at what it is we know about what causes cancer, certainly maybe one of the best examples of a direct or very close relationship between two things you can see in relationship between smoking and tobacco use and cancer. So people who smoke, people who use other forms of tobacco increase greatly their risk of developing cancer. And I'm sure that there are probably other sorts of toxic or hazardous substances that people might be exposed to. They might be in the environment, they might be in the workplace, that would also increase their risk of certain sorts of cancers. Are there many things that we could point to that would be, as is the case with smoking, we would say this particular thing is a known carcinogen, and if you're exposed to that in significant amounts, then that's going to significantly increase your risk of developing cancer.
Sure. My apologies to the public health people. I'll probably miss a couple of them in here. Number one, the top of the list for environmental exposures is asbestos. Mm-hmm. And I think that what this gets back to is the relationship between chronic inflammatory processes and the development of cancer. And so, you know, all of the nonsense that we listen to in the legal and legislative arena around asbestos is related to, well, which kind of asbestos are we going to call cancer-causing? And, well, maybe this kind of asbestos, but these other mineral dust fibers that people are exposed to, we're not going to, et cetera. And that's nonsense. I think for the individual person, the degree to which they respond to any individual fiber, whether it's a rock fiber, silica, or it's cotton dust or any of the chronic dust exposures that people are exposed to, probably in certain people lead to an increased risk of cancer. Now, asbestos is clearest. Now, the place that people don't pay attention to asbestos because they think it's been banned and it's not used anymore is in the area of vermiculite. Mm-hmm. Now, most good NPR listeners are also gardeners, as I am, and we're all familiar with potting soil. And potting soil is vermiculite. And what vermiculite is it's mined, it's an ore, and you take the ore and crush it, and then you heat it to a high temperature, and it pops like popcorn. That's why it's so lightweight, and that's why it's used to lighten up soils for potting and starting new plants. Unfortunately, most of the vermiculite in the country is heavily contaminated with asbestos. Now, it goes beyond that. Of course, most of it was mined up in Montana, in Libby, Montana, where there's a staggering incidence of mesothelioma and lung cancer. But it was processed throughout the country. We have a big processing plant here in Detroit in the Dearborn area, but all through the country there were major sites. And then after they processed it into potting soil, or I'll tell you something else in a minute, they left big slag heaps of it around that neighborhood kids could play in, et cetera, et cetera. You can see where this is leading. Now, the other thing is, originally, where did asbestos come from? Why was there so much asbestos out there? Well, for many, many years, it was required to have asbestos in your construction projects. And that came from the old Triangle Waste Fire in New York, where the steel-girdered building collapsed suddenly in a fire. And they realized that steel gives out much more quickly than wood and unpredictably, and therefore required asbestos to be placed on steel girders in all buildings from that point on. So we had it in the building codes for a long time. And people think we've sort of gotten away from that and we don't pack our boilers with it anymore and aren't we safe. But we here in Michigan have, I think just in southeast Michigan, something like 800,000 homes with loose fill insulation. It's a product called Zonalite, and it's just vermiculite. It's like somebody sprayed couple hundred gallons of potting soil into the rafters in your attic, and it works as a pretty good insulator, but it's also contaminated with asbestos. So those are the kinds of things that we see, and I think asbestos is at the top of the list. And when we get down to people who are mining silica or nickel or some of the other heavy metals, there's a certain knowledge that they're a problem, and most responsible places now have exposure control to those.
So here, there's a possibility that people might, depending on what kind of work they do, they might be exposed to something that is a carcinogen. So that's one thing for people to think about. And the other thing, obviously, if you ask the question, well, what could I do that will greatly reduce my risk of developing cancer, probably one of the top things that you'd say, don't smoke, and if you do smoke, stop. So maybe there are some obvious things like that. What about, I think that there is concern, people have concern that we might be exposed to a variety of things, toxins, pollutants, hazardous substances in our daily lives, perhaps in very small amounts, but that we're still not quite sure what a lifetime exposure to things like that that might possibly be in the air, might possibly be in the water, and so forth. And you know, what a lifetime of exposure to things like that might be and how these things might add up. What do you think about that idea that, that there may be indeed a variety of kind of hazards that we're exposed to just in our daily lives that might contribute to our risk?
Well, you know, I think as I get older, my mother gets smarter and smarter. And she talks about everything in moderation. And I think the human body is really a miraculous organism. And it can handle most chemicals and most things when it sees it in small amounts. And there are very few things, precious few things, that minute contact with leads to a direct cause of disease. I mean, we pass through an awful lot of stuff. It's when we're constantly exposed to something. If I might, for smoking, take for example, a lot of people, you know, just get their shorts in a knot about people smoking in restaurants. And to the extent that somebody walks by you and is smoking or is smoking in the far end of the restaurant, it may be annoying, it may be irritating. I personally find it disgusting, but it's not a health risk unless you've got an acute asthma attack going on. The people who it's a health risk for are the waiters, the bartenders, the cooks, who are in it 8 to 10 hours a day. So I think we have a great tendency to look for the things that are annoying and blow them up into meaningless things and to forget who it's really important for. You know, unless I'm up there mucking about in my attic with loose-fill insulation, which I happen to have. I have a 50-year-old house here in Grosse Pointe, 60-year-old house now. It's not really a risk, but if I happen to be a cable man or a ventilation person and I'm up there climbing around in people's attics all the time, constantly stirring that stuff up, then I have a bigger risk for it. And again, the same thing in smoking. Just because somebody walks by me smoking a cigarette and I crinkle my nose at it, there's no health risk there. The health risk is the poor slob working at the counter, working in the place, being exposed to smoke all day. And I think those are the things. So I think that you'd get into Howard Hughes land and go into seclusion and everything else if you try to avoid every single possible exposure to everything in the world. And I don't – there's just no scientific validity to 99.999% of these minimal exposures. And so I think that, you know, the chances that somebody that has an occasional diet soda is going to die from bladder cancer because of saccharin or some other similar compound is infinitesimal and not measurable. The fact that, you know, somebody who has an annual mammogram is going to die from breast cancer is such a trivial risk compared to finding breast cancer early. And yet we tend to focus on those things. And I don't know whether it's because it makes good press or because we like to focus on the little things. But there are big things out there that we can and should do. And I think the other thing that comes into play here is your genetics. Now, let me give an example here, one that's not cancer-related. If you are allergic to penicillin, and you're exposed to even small amounts of penicillin, that can be a lethal reaction for you. Most people aren't. That's a minor genetic difference in whether or not we become allergic to that particular compound. And it clearly is genetic. If I'm not allergic to it, I can, you know, drink a gallon of it, have an injection of it, it's not a problem. And it may be the truth. That may be the truth with several of these exposures, and we think that's clearly true now in lung cancer. People who have, and we published this last year, people who have a relative with lung cancer, first-degree relative with lung cancer, especially one who gets it under age 50, who themselves smoke, have anywhere from a 2.5 to 5 times the risk of developing lung cancer compared to other smokers. Were already elevated to their own risk. And we clearly see that linkage in families. We have a large genetic analysis of lung cancer going on here in Detroit where smoking is unfortunately prevalent, and we're in a state with a legislature that's not been able to deal with the issue yet. So we're the only smoking state around in the upper Midwest. But it clearly is genetic, and I suspect that some of these problems may be genetic, but it takes more than a trivial exposure. It takes constant exposure. So that, you know, if you eat trout once in a while, that's fine. I imagine if you ate fish from the Detroit River every single day of your life, you know, there might be a problem there. It's just everything in moderation. I think you can do fine with it.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. John Ruckdeschel. He is the Associate Dean of Cancer Affairs at Wayne State University's School of Medicine in Detroit. He is an internationally recognized lung cancer physician, and we're talking about generally about cancer this morning, and I'm sure that if you have some questions that the doctor will do his best to answer your questions. Whenever we have physicians on the show, I do try to suggest to people that we can't do diagnosis over the phone. That we can't do, but certainly
general questions. Well, unless they're willing to pay
the bill. Well, we can discuss fees later. We have a couple of people here ready to go. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. First caller is in Champaign and on line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. What about the impact of, and we're using more and more of it, herbicides and also certainly in terms of pesticides? I mean, it just seems sort of the accumulative effect of these things. I don't know, especially when it gets into the water supply.
Yeah, again, I think it depends on where you are. I think if you're in a farming area, and there's a lot of commercial use of pesticides in that area, and it is in your drinking water. I mean, there is a contamination in there, and I realize you might not always get a straight answer out of the authorities about that. But if that's the case, then yes, I suspect there is a risk, and one would want to pay attention to that. I think that, you know, the way you prevent that for the average person who does not live in that particular environment is, you know, you wash fruit and vegetables when you get them, sort of common sense things, and then I think the impact is fairly low. We do see broader impacts in the agricultural arena, where people are using all manner of stimulants to growth and antibiotics, et cetera, that we wind up with antibiotics, with bacteria that are resistant to many of our antibiotics. It's not quite the cancer risk, but it's not clear that we see there an increased cancer risk from that.
What about the wasn't there a problem in terms of the farm workers, especially out in California and stuff? Is that true or?
Oh, absolutely, and I think that's exactly my point, is they're not exposed on a trivial basis. They're exposed to it every day, every single day. They're walking through fields that have been sprayed. They're in the dirt. They're picking plants. They're touching the leaves. It's on their clothes. Yeah, I mean, that's a very different kind of exposure than you and I are exposed to, you know, walking into the grocery store and picking up a piece of fruit and deciding to eat it or not.
Thank you.
All right. Let's go to Effingham for another caller. Line four. Hello.
Yes. On the good old PBS some years ago, I have two things or three. The show was about this man who worked in the harvesting of asbestos where they mined it. And he worked there his whole life, wasn't very old, and he died of asbestos exposure. Then his daughter died, who her exposure was from his clothing, and that was portrayed, you know, with facts matter of factly on the, I can't remember, it's been some years ago, but the transferring of that stuff around and not knowing how much of it there is in a given place, and then how people are affected by that, I assume is not knowable yet. Another thing is I live in a 1940 house, built in 1940, and in the basement it looks like asbestos to me that was used to line the heat and cold air returns, and I'm not sure about that, and I'm kind of worried about it, but the last thing is every year, all the years I lived up north of here and towns between the fall burning of leaves. And do you know any science about that? And I know it's very toxic to try to breathe that stuff, and especially at night, you know, when it lays low on the air. Would you know anything about those, the asbestos and the leaves?
Well, sure. The asbestos is or can be an issue, and what you would want to do is not be doing your own plumbing work. So being downstairs, stripping that stuff off until you know what it is would be an issue. And I think you could talk to any plumber in the area could advise you on that. But certainly people who were exposed in that fashion to steam fitters and people in the Navy when they were working with boilers in the Navy during the Second World War, clearly they have an increased risk of problems. So one way to do it is just avoid that particular area. The second one was
on burning leaves and yard waste and trash in general. Usually people mix it all up. They just throw everything they don't want into this heap of down tree limbs and leaves. And
yeah, I think that you have to look at that. Again, there's an irritation factor. It's annoying, especially if you have one of many different pulmonary diseases where you might have irritated airways, and that just makes it worse. Now, on the other hand, think about that for a second. How much of the year do you ever get exposed to that? The answer is not much. Now, if you happen to work in a facility where you're constantly burning waste, then we're talking about something different. And that's really, you know, my pitch is to get people to think, what are the more serious things? The fact that you happen to inhale people burning, you know, as people do in the country, burn their garbage or whatever else, it's a momentary thing. It's not a continuous 10, 12 hours a day smelling that unless you happen to work, again, in a factory or in a facility where that's what they do is burn garbage 20 hours a day.
Well,
and then I think it may well be a problem for that. You had one more in there. I'm sorry.
I think basically we got it. I think it was the asbestos and it was the burning. And I think certainly there are a lot of communities now have banned open burning for a number of reasons, but certainly out of it's not something you want to do out of courtesy to anybody who might live around you who does have reactive airways. And if you had people who have things like asthma and emphysema, it's certainly not good for them.
Right.
We're a little bit past our midpoint here, or maybe right at the midpoint here. Our guest for this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. John Ruckdeschel. He is the president and chief executive officer of the Barbara Ann Karmus Cancer Institute and Cancer Center. That's in Detroit. He's also the Associate Dean of Cancer Affairs at Wayne State University School of Medicine in Detroit. He is a internationally recognized lung cancer physician and researcher, and we're talking about cancer. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Next, we'll talk with someone in Savoy on our line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
Yes, I'd like you to address two separate questions here. One is that we have blown-in ceilings in our home that was built in 1971, and I've been concerned that some of this popcorn material might have asbestos in it, and should I be concerned about that? The second one is I drink a beverage. It's a powdered beverage that you stir in with water, and I've been drinking like 5 glasses a day for 20 years, but I notice it has phenyl, the artificial sweetener, phenylalanine, if I pronounced that correctly, and also coloring called Red Lake, and I'm wondering if I should be concerned because I've been drinking such large amounts of that every day for so long.
Well, we can be pretty sure that it isn't short-term toxic since you're still with us and doing seemingly well here. But I think this is the kind of thing where you're drinking a fair amount of it and you've been doing it over many years.
Yes, 20 years to be exact.
And so I'm not quite sure what the reason you're using that particular product is, but phenylalanine is not the problem. It's just whatever the red dye, the colors in there.
Okay.
The dyes may be over time. But, you know, you don't know, because we don't have a test for it, whether you are able to process those chemicals out of your body without harm or whether you can't and you're storing them away.
Okay.
And these kinds of long-term exposures, like asbestos, like cigarette smoking, can take 20, 30, 40 years before the effects become manifest as a clinical cancer. So I quite frankly, I think that breaks my rule or my mother's rule of everything in moderation.
Yes, it does. Mm-hmm. I drink huge amounts of beverage when I eat my meals.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with drinking lots of beverages. I think it's just, you know, mixing that up a little bit might be a little, in your particular case, without any evidence to back that up, might be a reasonable thing to do.
Hmm.
Now, the other thing about the blown-in ceiling,
yes.
I'm not quite sure what you mean. If what you mean is that material that they have, so it gives it like a butter, a popcorn,
yes,
like
effect. Yes, very fine popcorn. It's
that's
not crumbly-looking stuff.
That's not asbestos.
Okay, that's great. Then I don't need to worry.
No.
All right, then. Thank you so much for your help.
Very good. Thank you. We'll go
Bye-bye.
On to another caller here. This is someone on a cell phone. This is our line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
My question regards radon. I've talked to several people in town regarding the radon levels in my house. And they were in the 6 to 7 range. I don't remember the calibration they were using for the tests. And then I talked to another fella about getting an evacuation pump put in my basement. And he said, I really wouldn't worry about it very much because the radon levels here in Illinois are so low. And in Canada, they're much, much higher, and they don't even worry about it there. So I'm kind of confused. I'm getting mixed messages on the radon. I wondered if your guest could enlighten me a little bit on that.
Sure. I don't know exactly what level you have and how that runs up against what are abnormal. If it's in an abnormal zone by the testing, I'd make sure I'd get it tested by one of the public health authorities that you can, not just a kit. Obviously, somebody's trying to sell kits and the equipment to clean it up, et cetera, that's a bit of a commercial scam. So you want if there's any hint of it, fine. But the other thing to look at is how much time do you spend in the basement? If it's your family room and you're down there all the time, then it might be significant. If what you've got is a cellar with exposed stone walls to it in an older house and you're down there all the time, you've got your workshop down there or whatever, then there may be an issue with it. But if you've got a basement and you occasionally walk to the basement, it's not going to be an issue, and I wouldn't go through a lot of craziness to deal with it. But I think if you're concerned about the levels and you're not certain about the levels, I would not I'm out of a different state. I can't get in trouble with your local retailers. I mean, I would just be careful and remember that people are busy selling products here, and so I would be before I invested in a whole bunch of other excitement about this, I think I would have that tested by your county health agency or whoever else it is.
Actually, I did test it. Where I got the kit was from the public health agency. And
did they say that's an elevated level in your area?
Yes. Yeah.
And how often are you in the basement?
Well, that's just it. I tested it up in my living room, and it was high there also. And I guess I'm thinking, gee, I better do something about this. But then when I talked to a fellow that I really respected his opinion, he sent me an article regarding the Canadian specifics, and by going by that, our levels aren't high here at all compared to what they have in Canada.
Well, I think you have to go as imperfect as it is, and I'm not pretending that there's a perfect answer to this. I think if you've got public health people in your area, they've given you a kit, it is elevated, and their recommendation is based on that you should go ahead and have one of the evacuation devices, then I would consider that. I think, what the Canadians do is what they do. I mean, they do a lot of things different from us, and some of it makes sense, and some of it may not. I think that I always look at it, what is the consequence of it? I mean, if it's a huge expense and it's going to bankrupt you, et cetera, then, maybe we have to put a lot of thought into this. On the other hand, if it's the expense is reasonable and you don't do it, and then something develops in the family later on, you're going to kick yourself in the head about it. So, those are the kinds of trade-offs that you make. There's no question that radon is a carcinogen and can cause cancer itself. So it's not something that I would ignore.
I see. All righty. Well, thank you very much.
Let me ask you, Dr. Ruckdeschel, about something else that's just been in the news here recently. Dr. Ron Herbermann, who directs the University of Pittsburgh Cancer Institute, recently has come out with a recommendation concerning cell phones. He seems to be concerned. He was not saying absolutely that there is evidence that cell phone use causes cancer. However, apparently there's enough so that he's concerned enough so that he is suggesting to people that when they use cell phones, that they use some kind of earpiece or some sort of device so that they're not holding the cell phone right up against the side of their head. And I think he said that, you know, just to be on the safe side, he's suggesting that people do that. And I'm just interested in what you think about any of the evidence that shows that there can be some sort of health risk associated with the use of cell phones.
Yeah, to date, there has been absolutely no evidence of that. And I think what Ron was quoting, and I know Ron well, was what he described as unpublished data that he had seen. How on earth Ron let himself get out in the public press with this, with that kind of weak data, is beyond me. I think that if he had a concern, as I read through that, and I haven't talked to him since then, it was that young kids with cell phones who talk an incessant period of time on their phones might, you know, that may be where you put some effort into it, but I think that, you know, for those of us who get on the phone, do our business, and get off, I hardly see the necessity to run through that. Certainly no evidence has been presented yet. Now, I'm not one to say that there won't be evidence, and that, in fact, Ron has seen the preliminary evidence and is setting off the alarms before, all the data becomes clear to the rest of us. But I don't think that data is out there right now. And my sense is that Ron's got, to a certain degree, misquoted in this. But I don't want to speak for him or against him on this one. My personal belief is I use the reason to use earphones and the reason to use Bluetooth, et cetera, in your car is because it's safer driving. I think for the average person who makes a call and then hangs up when they're done, and isn't sitting yakking on the phone for 12 hours a day, that I just don't think the evidence is there yet.
Right. Yeah, it did seem, from what I have read, it did seem that he had a particular concern about children, but was making this as a general kind of recommendation. So I suppose people can do with that what they will. And personally, I think if you're going to talk for long periods of time, it's just actually a little bit more comfortable to use some kind of a
Absolutely.
Device like that. Anyway, let's continue. We'll talk with someone in Charleston. This is line number 4. Hello.
Hello. Yes, I was wondering if you could address the issue of cancers caused by viruses such as HPV. And maybe you could talk about also if you know anything about these new gradations that they put on cells that have been exposed to HPV that are going through changes, but they're not yet cancerous. So they might be called low-grade cells that have some changes or effects from exposure to HPV, human papillomavirus, but they're not cancerous yet. Just how, you know, there's more more ways of knowing in advance what's going on and possibly prevention. I don't know if you're in a position to talk about those kind of things or not.
Sure. I think that the relationships between viruses and cancer are intriguing. There are some kinds of lymph node cancers, Burkitt's lymphoma, for example, and its relationship to the Epstein-Barr virus. There's a nasopharyngeal cancer, and the and cervical cancer are all cancers where there's pretty clear linkage. There are interesting tidbits of linkage in mesothelioma with the simian virus 40 that was contaminated the polio vaccines in the 50s and 60s. There's some question about it in bronchoalveolar lung cancer and a couple of other cancers. But, you know, the problem with that, with direct causes of that, is that it's hard. You know, the body, if it was just a virus, the body would reject it because your body can make an immune reaction to something that's foreign. The reason that your immune system doesn't get rid of cancer is it's you run amok, and your body doesn't reject you on an immune basis. So it's usually a virus in combination with something else. Mm. Now, HPV clearly causes cervical cancer. Certain strains of HPV clearly cause a cervical cancer and may, in fact, be involved in some head and neck cancers and esophageal cancers. That's still being worked through, but as a cofactor rather than as the direct inciting agent. Now,
can you talk anything about the different gradations?
Yes, that's what I'm just going to come to that right now. We know that from the time a cell, a normal dividing cell in the body, is exposed either to a carcinogen or to a virus or some blend of these things, that extremely rarely one hit, one mutation, turns that cell malignant. That's an extremely rare event. Usually it's an accumulation of small nicks to the genetic material that accumulate over a period of 10, 20, 30, 40 years. And over that period of time, the cells begin to look a little bit funny. And you're familiar with this from pap smears. Every woman is, with dysplasia. Mm-hmm. Those are cells that look a little bit funny. Now, that doesn't mean they're going to become cancer, but they can be. They're more likely to become cancer. Most women who have an abnormal pap smear and are said to have dysplasia, it gets better on its own, or you do something simple locally, and it's done. But some do go on to cancer. So, yes, that's clearly there, and I think any woman who's had HPV exposure knows that, clearly needs to have her annual pap smear. And I, again, as a non-gynecologic oncologist, I can't say whether they're upping that recommendation to more frequently than that, but I would certainly follow the advice of my gynecologist in that case. We see the same process in virtually every organ. So where we're able to get cells, whether it's from the throat or the urinary tract or from the lungs, the esophagus, the same thing. We find these atypical cells, dysplastic cells that look, I'll put quotation marks around it, funny. Nothing funny about them, but they look funny under the microscope, but they're not clearly malignant yet. And they're clearly a warning, and they're clearly a red flag and should not be ignored.
Right. Do you know that if dysplasia is the same as squamous intraepithelial lesions?
It's similar. There's a series of steps that it goes through.
Mm-hmm.
I would group the dysplasias into varying degrees of severity. And once you get to an intraepithelial neoplasia, that's sort of on the more serious end of it.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right.
You're
welcome. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Dr. John Ruck-Deschelle. He is the Associate Dean of Cancer Affairs at Wayne State University's School of Medicine in Detroit. He is a lung cancer physician and researcher, and we're talking generally about cancer. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Back earlier in the conversation, you said there were really two things that had contributed significantly to the decline in cancer deaths. One of those was in convincing people not to smoke, or if they do smoke, to stop. The other was that we have improved screening for a number of cancers, and I suppose the big ones would be breast and prostate and perhaps also colon and rectal cancer, because there are a number of tests that are they're minimally invasive, they're not terribly involved or terribly expensive, and so that there are things that can be done on a regular basis. In addition to those sorts of things, or maybe you'd like to talk about those, what do you recommend, or what are the recommendations for basic kind of screening tests that people should have?
Well, unfortunately, I wish there was more. I think it's pretty clear that people need to have, after age 50, and again, this is in families where we do not have a genetic basis of concern. So if you've got three other family members or a first-degree relative who had colon cancer in their 50s or 60s, then I'd start this process earlier and more aggressively than if it had never appeared in the family. But just for the average person, I think after age 50, colonoscopy, somewhere between a 5- and 10-year basis, I think they're still threshing that out, I personally would be happy to see it be every 10 years, quite frankly. But that clearly would be an addition. Mammography, pap smears are clearly a benefit. There are other tests now that we can do that go beyond that. I think that the CAT scan for lung cancer has been proposed as a way to pick this up early, and there's been a lot of turmoil about some of the studies about this. There's a big national study underway. And I think whatever that shows, it's clear that screening the whole population for early lung cancer is probably not going to be a cost-effective or useful way to do it. We'll pick up earlier cancers, but at a huge cost. But I think there are subpopulations of people who would benefit from CAT scanning of their lungs. I think if you have a first-degree relative with lung cancer and you've been a heavy smoker yourself, I'd sign up for an annual CAT scan. If you've had a prior cancer, lung cancer, then certainly you'd get one anyway as part of your therapy. One of the cancers that's becoming more common is esophageal cancer. And it is seen in middle-aged men with indigestion, chronic indigestion. And they develop a condition called Barrett's esophagus, which is sort of a reaction, again, to inflammation of the end of the esophagus where the stomach acid washes up there, causing your indigestion. And that's a pre-malignant lesion in that area. And so screening for that and going after this and more aggressively in middle-aged men with, particularly men, but with indigestion, chronic indigestion, of course, there are many out there. And I think getting a screening program that works for that would make some sense. The other big area, I think, is in melanoma. We're seeing a huge increase in melanomas. And I'm not particularly a partisan participant in the debate about whether that's due to loss of our protective ozone layer or just, you know, more people spending time in the sun because it's a cool thing to do and they want to look better with a tan. I've gotten used to the Michigan pasty white color that most of us are up here in the winter. But a lot of people don't, and there are a lot of people who use tanning beds and get out in the sun. And there are effective screening methods for this. And we know that there's a syndrome called dysplastic nevus syndrome, where people who have a lot of moles, some of them are funny. They look a little bit irregular, they're a little bit dark, and those folks need to be screened on a regular basis. So if you have a family, if you or any other members of your family have a lot of moles and a lot of freckles, going in and getting a dermatologist to look at that would make sense. And if you're diagnosed as having dysplastic nevus, A, you want to avoid the sun and stringently, and B, be screened every year, have that skin examined and photographed every year so you can do that. Those are the kinds of things that we can do. But, you know, what we don't have is a pill or a foodstuff. You know, go out and eat this or eat that and you won't get cancer. We just don't have that. There's none of those simple tasks are going to do it.
We have two other callers here. We'll try to get them both in. I'm sure we can. Next up is someone in Mahomet and on line one. Hello.
Hi. Hello.
Yes.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I didn't think I was going to get in because you've been talking so much and not taking questions. That man is a joke. Ho-ho. Okay, my question is, I'm a 75-year-old woman. Recently had a ultrasound, right? Okay, the ultrasound showed an ovary that was about the size of an egg. We have no cancer in my family. I've never had cancer. Except for the few old age stuff, I'm fairly healthy. Okay, the ultrasound showed a ovarian cyst the size of an egg. It showed that part of it was normal, but part of it is, I don't know, they're kind of worried about. Anyway, this is what happened. Two GYN OBs independently said, have it out. My primary doctor is saying, okay, I guess whatever you want to do. I don't know what to do. They've told me to just have it out. I would have it out if I was assured it was just going to be keyhole surgery, but they can't do that because I don't know what's going to happen until I get in there, you know, that kind of thing. What should I do?
It certainly is not something you want to ignore. You've had two gynecologists look at this and say...
This is since February.
This needs to be at least biopsied or removed.
They say they can't biopsy it because they can't pull that thing through. It might spread the cancer if they went in and tried to biopsy. The only thing these doctors say is we can use keyhole surgery. We can go in. You'll be on the table. You'll be out. And you won't know until you wake up whether it's keyhole surgery or general. What should I do?
Well, you live in a small town. Where do you live?
Right there where Carl is. Sheila,
it's not very far away from where we are here in Champaign, Urbana.
Excellent facility. Carl Medical Center, Urbana.
Yeah. I think when you've got mixed opinions like this...
I've already gotten two opinions.
Yeah, and they're both the same.
Right.
That's what I do then.
Is have them open my belly?
Yep.
Why? Why when the woman...
Well, I think, first of all, if you have...
Just let me say that the OYGN doctor said, in your case, there's a 70% chance that it's not cancer. I really don't want to have general surgery. I would go for the keyhole surgery in a minute.
Well, I think we're going to wander off a little too hard to give you a clear answer here without
somebody
seeing you. I think that would be a little bit...
My question is, you say go ahead with it. I say I've had two people say yes. I said I don't want to have it done unless it's just a simple surgery. I've had the general surgery, and I don't want to go through that again. This was diagnosed in February. I saw the doctors. I'm supposed to get another ultrasound in a couple of months, and that's where I'm at right now. What should I do? Please don't go off on a tangent.
Well, I think...
it's very hard for the doctor not knowing you or your case or being able to look
at.
He can't really. It's kind of unfair to.
If he had 100 people with my problem, what would he tell 100 of them to do?
I would tell you, having been seen, that the only thing that would keep me from doing surgery is if they do a repeat ultrasound now, and this has not changed over this period of time, then I would feel comfortable watching it with ultrasound every once in a while. Otherwise, I think it needs to come out.
Thank you very much.
All right. I'm hoping that that helps.
I'm sorry I got so emotional.
Well, no, you don't need to apologize.
You know her ovaries, how she is when she's maybe got cancer? I'm sorry.
No, ma'am, there's no need for you to apologize. I'm just trying to make you understand and that it's kind of putting the doctor in a tough position here because he doesn't know your case.
Rather than specific. In general, with a hub... 100 people, and he gave me a general answer, which I've already heard from my doctor, which is what we're doing.
All right. Well, we wish you the best. We're hoping that helps.
I love your program. All right. Goodbye.
All right. We'll try and get one more caller in here in Champaign, and this is line number 2. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
My question is this. My father-in-law died with prostate cancer, but not of prostate cancer. My husband at this point is a 10-year prostate cancer survivor. He had hormone suppression, direct beam radiation, and he had a seed implant, and he's been fine ever since. What kind of risk is our son facing?
Increased risk. How old was your husband when he got it?
53.
And your father?
No, it was his father.
His father. How old was he when he got it?
Probably in his 60s.
Yeah, this is one of the features that we see that with when you've got bad genes in a family, and I'm not sure we have the specific gene here for the prostate cancer risk, but when you see this pattern in a family, is it starts showing up 10 years earlier. And so I would think that your son, A, is at increased risk, and B, ought to start his regular screening with both rectal exams and with PSAs in his 40s.
Okay. That was what I've been told. I just was kind of curious if anything had changed.
Nope.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thanks. Well, we're just about the point where we have to stop. Just, I mean, real quick, perhaps I should have asked you back when we were talking about HPV, your position on the vaccine that we now have for that?
I have two stepdaughters, 12 and 9, and they're both getting it.
Okay, so you would say would go along with that recommendation that seems pretty much to be now a general recommendation that young women have it. What about say women who are not in their teens who have already been sexually active in their life? Would you suggest that a woman say in their 20s or 30s?
Well, I think it depends on whether they're HPV positive or not.
Uh-huh.
I mean, as I understand the literature, it's not particularly helpful if you're already positive, but.
Generally speaking, is there something down the road here that you think is going to be a major advance anytime soon, or would you expect things would be sort of, in a sense, more slowly kind of going along as we have been?
I think things are going to keep going along slowly. This is a very, very complex disease. There is not a single cause, and we have been burned innumerable times leaping to conclusions. When we just don't have solid data. It is just a very complex problem, and we're going to, I think, suffer through incremental change rather than monumental change for quite some time. Mm-hmm. I'd be ecstatic if something spectacular came along, but I don't see it on the horizon. I think that my daughter, who's a physician now as well and finishing her training, it may be more realistic for her to start thinking in those terms in her practice career, but for me in my early 60s, I'll be very happy if we can get cancer to a chronic disease, one that we can live with like diabetes. I'd be ecstatic if we can get there.
All right. Our guest is Dr. John Ruckdeschel. He is the Associate Dean of Cancer Affairs at Wayne State University School of Medicine in Detroit. Dr. Ruckdeschel, thank you very much.
You're most welcome.